Movie Tuesday podcast, episode 3, which means we've officially graduated from coincidence to pattern, so congratulations all around. I am Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and as always, I'll be hosting an in-depth conversation every Tuesday with somebody smart on sports stories and topics that go beyond the field of play. Speaking of smart, today's guest is David Epstein. David is a terrific writer with Sports Illustrated. If you remember the Ray Lewis deer antler spray story, that was him. He's also the author of a new book called The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. David, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing, and how does it feel to release your very first book into the wild?
It's a rush. I woke up yesterday with pre-race jitters I haven't had since I used to run the 800 meters in college, and I didn't expect that at all. But I guess when you put a lot of time, working on something that then has this one moment of sort of release, I guess maybe that's to be expected.
Now, unlike your college racing experience, there was no vomiting in a trash can at any point, was there yesterday?
No, fortunately not. I guess I left some of those habits behind. No vomiting.
Now, so that is actually a small detail from the book. Now, I've read the book, and it's great. It's fascinating, and it's also accessible for idiots like me who haven't taken a real science class since high school. So all those things are good. And I think best of all, like, I really think if people out there, if they read this, it's going to make them watch and appreciate sports in a new way. Now, I want to kind of get to the underlying premise of the book. It sort of looks at the old idea we all have of nature versus nurture in sports. And to grossly oversimplify that, you know, how much of LeBron James, for instance, being a great basketball player is because he's put countless hours of sweat and toil into practicing? And how much of that is because he was born with the body of LeBron James? Now, your book, though, it kind of says, here's what the new science can tell us about that. And one, to me, one of the really surprising things and interesting things in the book was that some of the athletic traits that most of us tend to figure are a matter of hard work and determination are actually rooted in genetics. And conversely, some of the things that we consider to be basically genetic lottery gifts are actually related to practice and effort. Now, the one specific thing in the book that really stood out with me of that was the ability to hit a major league fastball. Now, I always thought guys like Albert Pujols or Barry Bonds, they just have faster reaction time than a guy like you or a guy like me. But you actually write that that's not the case at all. And you talk about how the fact that neither one of them could really get a hit off softball pitcher Jenny Finch. For those of you who don't know, Jenny Finch was, you know, gold medal winning softball pitcher of Team USA. Went out one day and pitched a bunch of major leaguers. Can you take me through that story and tell us why the world's best hitters whiff, even when they were trying to hit a bigger ball, and what that tells us sort of about nature versus nurture when it comes to hitting?
Sure, and I thought the exact same thing that you did, that you just said, until I then scored better on a visual reaction time test than Albert Pujols did.
You're kidding.
And then I said, well, that's not so impressive because he was only in the 66th percentile compared to a bunch of college students at Washington University in St. Louis where they tested him.
And
so
how is it possible then that, like how is he such a good hitter if he's not even as good as the average college student?
The secret is, well, he was better than the average, but he was only in the 66th percentile, which you wouldn't, you know, I would have thought that he would be off the charts, or certainly better than me. I certainly would have thought that. And it turns out that his reaction speeds are sort of irrelevant. Whether you're a teacher, doctor, lawyer, journalist, or Albert Pujols, when you're dragged into a lab and given tests of reaction speed, the average always hovers around 200 milliseconds or a fifth of a second, and baseball players are no different than random citizens. And so to go back to what was happening with Jenny Finch, so when Jenny first at the Pepsi All-Star softball game in 2003, she was sort of pitching batting practice. She pitches from 43 feet away, mm-hmm. in the mid 60 mile per hour range, which, so the ball has the same transit time as about a mid 90s fastball would from baseball mound 60 feet and 6 inches away.
Right.
And so the guys thought, you know, the ball's bigger. It's the same transit time. They thought they were, you know, going to have a couple knocks and, you know, put on a display for the crowd and hit some softballs really far. And actually, so did Jenny. When I talked to her, she said originally they were going to put a net in front of her because she was worried about getting a line drive hit straight back at her. So
Wow.
she had no idea what was going to happen at first.
So everybody figured this was going to be, like you said, because of the, you know, the distance is shorter. So even though the pitch is going slower and the ball is bigger, it's going to be roughly equivalent in terms of the amount of time you have to react as a major league fastball.
Right. And as good as Jenny Finch is, she does, I mean, female professional softball players do get hits off of her.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that she, that, you know, Albert Pujols wasn't even going to be able to hit a foul ball, I think, was a surprise for both of them and certainly for me. And so what happened was she started pitching to these players, and not only were they missing, they were missing horribly. I think Brian Giles it was who basically spun in a circle. He missed so badly.
Wow.
And Pujols is missing by 6 inches. And you can sort of see him on one of the pitches. He almost like steps out, you know, surprised by what he's seeing. And it's a perfect pitch. And it turns out that, again, major leaguers have perfectly pedestrian reaction times, 200 milliseconds it takes them to initiate muscular action. And that's about half the time it takes a fastball to get to the plate, just
wow.
to initiate the muscular action. So really, you can't, humans don't have biology fast enough to accomplish that by reacting. We don't have a visual system that's fast enough to track a fastball, because the angular change as it gets close to you is so quick that you could just as well close your eyes when the ball's halfway in, because you already have to know where the ball is going, where
right.
you're swinging. And so guys like Pujols have to decide well before the halfway mark, just after the ball's out of the pitcher's hand, where they're going to swing. And it turns out that they do that by learning certain anticipatory cues, like tells, that help them predict the future, where the ball is going. And they don't know that they're doing this, but you can figure out that they're doing it by, for example, in simulations, deleting a pitcher's shoulder. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Albert Pujols can't predict where the ball is going anymore.
Really?
So if
you were able to put some sort of, if this was legal and you're a pitcher, if I could put some sort of screen in front of me where the batter could not really see my
yeah.
body, and all they saw was the ball sort of coming out of a hole, like, would I be way more successful then?
For sure. So and in digital simulations, that's exactly what happens. Is different parts of a player's body will be deleted, or sometimes even players will be equipped in the more advanced studies with glasses that go opaque at a certain point during the delivery, so they can't pick up certain visual cues. And eventually you can turn them back into novices by depriving them of certain visual cues, because they need these body movements to predict where the ball is going to go ahead of time. And I think that sort of helps explain why a pitcher like Hideo Nomo can blow everybody away in his first year with an unusual body motion, and then he basically gets progressively worse as the guys start mentally encoding his body movements. But with Jenny Finch, that she has an unusual shoulder motion. The ball, the pattern of the seams, of the called the flicker, when the seams flash, is different in a softball. And so Albert Pujols is totally stripped of all the cues that he's encoded through many, many hours of practice that allow him to not rely on reaction speed. So he's turned back into you and I, left just reacting. And the fact is, we don't have the physiology to simply react quickly enough to something moving at that speed.
So it's almost like you have this learned or practiced like perceptual ability to, is it too much to say you're learning how to see the future? In a way,
no.
To see into the future?
I think that's exactly what it is. And it holds, like in the eye tracking studies of quarterbacks, for example, whereas if you did an eye tracking study of me, so Peyton Manning lets go of the ball in an average of 2.5 seconds.
Right.
So he has to operate at the speed of an unconscious process, basically. He can't think back to all this film study he did, you know, as if you were taking a test. And if you tracked my eyes, I would be looking at guys I wanted to throw to, whereas Peyton will be looking at spaces between players that are important to the relationship between them and where they're going to be. So he'll focus on spaces, whereas I would focus on players. And that's exactly because he's predicting what's going to be happening in the future. Meanwhile, of course, defensive coordinators are shuffling things around to try to basically present him with cues that confuse his prediction abilities.
Right. And that's sort of what makes a good pitcher good more than anything, right? Is being able to confuse the batters with cues almost, right? I mean, that's kind of...
Completely. And that goes beyond just body movements. It also goes to so any information a batter can get that allows them to anticipate helps. So, for example, one hitting coach named Perry Husband, who I interviewed, he analyzed every single pitch over one major league season. And I want to say it was about 500,000 pitches, I think.
Okay, that's I hope he had computers helping him with that analysis.
Oh, he did. He did. And then he looked at fastballs straight down the middle, like mm-hmm. directly in over the heart of the plate, and the difference in the average of major league hitters between an 0-2 count and a 2-0 count was 100 points. So just the information that allows them to make a better guess that the ball is going to be coming down the middle
right.
makes a difference of 100 points on the exact same pitch, just depending on some count information,
wow.
which isn't body information, but it's also an anticipatory cue.
Right. So again, it sort of helps you see the future. And, you know, and this, and you said this is a practiced thing. You learn these cues. Like you said, a new pitcher comes up and the hitters are likely going to get better the more they see this pitcher, if he's got some sort of unusual delivery, especially like someone like Nomo. Now, to me, this almost sounds like, so we're talking about, and sort of the, again, bounding back to the nature to nurture thing, this sounds like it's supporting that, I don't want to say it's the old adage of practice makes perfect, but also the sort of newfangled Malcolm Gladwell popularized adage of the 10,000 hour rule, which I think actually came from a Florida State professor, but you know, people mostly know it through one of Gladwell's books, that basically anybody can master something or get really good if they spend that 10,000 hours on it. Now, I don't want to put too many words in your mouth, but one of the things I also thought was interesting in the book is that you kind of debunk and put a ton of caveats on the idea of the 10,000 hour rule. So tell me why, even though we just talked about how practice is so important and nurture is so important, you know, 10,000 hours of jump shots aren't going to necessarily turn me into the next Steve Nash.
Right. Well, practice is incredibly important, and the right kind of practice is also incredibly important. But that was kind of never controversial in science. There was mm-hmm. never in some popular science writing, there's this idea that, you know, sometimes a writer will try to convince you that you thought everything was just talent, as if Albert mm-hmm. Pujols was just falling out of the sky.
Right.
But in the scientific literature, nobody argued. There's never – it's non-controversial that practice is really, really important. But for scientists, of course, the question has to be not is practice important, but how important is practice?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of practice is important? What else is important? And the 10,000-hour rule, Gladwell actually – sort of makes the caveat of, well, of course some of these people are more talented than you and I, but they also put in the 10,000 hours. Some other writers, including scientists, including K. Anders Ericsson, who actually did the original study on violinists,
mm-hmm.
Will often say, no, 10,000 hours is necessary and sufficient for any individual to become an expert in a given task. So nobody who does less than 10,000 hours will become elite, and everybody who does at least 10,000 hours will become elite. But it's utterly not true. I mean, the 10,000 hours, again, it comes from a violin study where Ericsson already started with a population of people who were in one of the most prestigious music academies in the world.
Okay.
So highly pre-screened. And then the 10,000 hours group were those that were identified by their instructors as future international soloists.
Mm-hmm.
So you've already screened out almost all of humanity. And when
right.
when you do that, you set up a study that can say nothing about innate talent. You know, this is like using like the NBA as a reference population for a height study. You know, you've already
right.
screened everybody out. And the fact is, even among those 10 elite violinists who had spent more hours in effortful kind of solitary practice than their lesser skilled peers had,
mm-hmm.
even among them, there was variance, which wasn't reported in the original paper, variance of over 500 hours. And that kind of gets to what the 10,000 hours really is, the 10,000 hour rule. It's an average of individual differences. And in chapter two, when I talk about the tale of two high jumpers,
right.
Just to put it shortly, one of them who had closer to 0 hours of deliberate practice or effortful practice, and the other closer to 20,000 hours. So between them, they had an average of 10,000 hours. But what you really want to know is the range. And the range was something like 0 to 20,000. In chess, to reach international master status, the average number of hours is 11,053. But the range is from some people who make it in 3,000 hours to other people who have gone to 25,000 and still haven't made it yet.
Right.
So really, you want to know where you are in the range, not what the average of all the individual differences
right.
is.
And that would seem that that range also seems to suggest that, like you said, there is not just nurture here, but there is some sort of nature component to this. You know, it would seem to me that somebody who only needs 3,000 hours to achieve that mastery versus someone who's 25,000 hours and counting and isn't there, you know, maybe they're not going to ever get there. It seems like there's got to be some sort of maybe innate difference between those two people when it comes to this particular thing they're trying to master.
There's in every single study that I could find, and I searched back for decades and decades and even centuries in some cases, when individuals are taught motor skills or spatial skills, individual differences emerge. Never, only in extremely simple tasks, extremely simple, like hitting a single button, does practice make people more equal. But in complex tasks, practice usually makes people less equal.
Really?
And the individual differences emerge. And identical twins progress at very similar rates, much more so than fraternal twins who have the same environment but different genes. Mm-hmm. And this shows up in every single study. In one of Erickson's own studies on darts, after 15 years of practice, only 28% of the variation in skill level had been accounted for after 15 years. At the rate of skill development that he documents in that paper, some of the people would need like a 10,000-year rule to catch up with some of the others. And God, that's one of Erickson's own papers.
I liked your idea, by the way, about like simple skill like button pushing. I wish we could make that a sport because then I could probably dominate. But going to button pushing on a keyboard. But no, I'm sure I'd get killed in speed typing as well.
One thing I noticed in some of the literature is the one thing that women always outperform men on are the fine motor skill tests. We just don't have very many sports that are arranged around that. But
right.
When I looked up the world's speed texting championships, women and girls often win.
Oh, that's a crushing blow for our gender, obviously.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, Keo, going back to where we talked about hitting in baseball, there was another thing interesting in there that why this seems to be largely a, like you put it, a software kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There
yeah.
is a place where hardware really matters, and that seems to be your actual physical eyes. So
right.
I'm just wondering, like, if tomorrow I named you the GM of the Mets,
yeah.
and I told you the draft's coming up, I give you a list of 100 prospects, and I say, you can have one of these two things to evaluate them. I will give you all of their standard scouting reports, or I will give you all of their eye exam scores.
Oh, jeez.
Which one of those things would you go with, and why?
I think if I had to choose between those two, I think I would still stick with the scouting reports because at that high level of achievement, most of them have been pretty highly pre-screened for their visual abilities already.
Mm-hmm.
So if the scouting report says this guy can really hit, that's partly an indirect measurement of his visual skills.
Right.
But if I could get – that's if I just had to pick one.
Mm-hmm.
But if I could get down to – sort of tiebreakers with guys, then I would love to use the visual skills. If I had guys I already felt the same about and had to pick between extra scouting reports and the visual skills, I'd go with the visual skills because the faster the ball moves, the more important they get. So as the guys move up levels, those become more important.
So you talked about a guy at the Dodgers who basically looked at eye exams for all these minor league players.
Yeah.
And he was pretty much able to predict these are the guys who are going to make it in the major leagues because they all have like 2010, 2012 vision.
He was
incredibly rare.
In addition to their visual acuity, so like 2010 means that's what Ted Williams had
mm-hmm.
too. That means that they can see from 20 feet away, like what I need to stand to 10 feet away to
mm-hmm.
see. And he did. This was Lewis Rosenbaum. He went into Dodgers camp and tested a whole range of visual abilities, including depth perception, contrast sensitivity, which you know would impact your ability to pick up the seams of the ball, and blindly, 2 years in a row, challenged by Tommy Lasorda, picked just from the visual scores two minor leaguers he thought would make it,
mm-hmm.
and the first one was Eric Karros, who went on to be Rookie of the Year
right.
and have a long, good career. And then the next was Mike Piazza, who had been drafted as a favor to one
right.
of Tommy Lasorda's friends.
Like
so
43rd round pick or something
yeah,
like that.
Went on to become the greatest hitting catcher of all time. So obviously those two predictions don't I still think there's some luck involved there.
Mm-hmm.
But even the average visual acuity of the Dodgers was hitters of hitters. Pitchers were sometimes worse. Hitters was 20/11 in one eye and 20/12 in another eye, and that's extremely unusual in the normal population.
Right. So in some respects, there is a place where nature really matters. But flipping it around, we always think we you know, one thing we love in sports is the scrappy guy who or woman who doesn't seem to have the obvious outward athletic talent, but they just work really hard. They just outwork everybody else. And we sort of moralize about those people, and we sort of hold them up as like they're more like us, and like there's a lot of mythology built around that character in sports. Now, but you write about that trainability actually might be something of a natural talent, not just a matter of like guts and heart and willpower. And you say that some people basically are genetically predisposed to respond to training, and they'll improve much more than other people. And also, some people sort of have genetically these different baseline levels of fitness or ability. I'm wondering, going back to that narrative I talked about a second ago, how does that dynamic play out in sports, and how did it play out in your own college track career?
So this is in endurance sports, sort of the most clear of all, but now there's plenty of evidence for this in sort of explosive training as well, that when I was looking at sort of older papers, particularly in sports psychology literature, they would often define talent before they started talking about it in the papers. And the definition was often something like prowess that precedes any opportunity for training. So it had to be something that was just there.
Like you're
And
tall, or you're strong, or you just seem fast without ever training with a sprint coach.
Exactly. And if it came after training, then it was totally not talent. Anything that came after training meant that it came from training. But what exercise and sports genetics, what we're learning is the same things that we learned that genetics taught us about medicine, which is that no two people respond exactly the same way because no two people have the same genome. And I think exercise genetics is really changing the definition of possibly the more important type of talent, certainly for certain sports, to one that says some people have a biological setup that allows them to profit more from the same amount of training as the next guy. And this happened in a dramatic way for me. When I was a national level 800 meter runner, I was a walk-on in college, and sort of didn't have great times coming in. I didn't have good aerobic capacity. I would actually go get tested by a pulmonologist who I still have one of his reports that said my result was consistent with very early stage emphysema.
Wow, so you're basically your baseline was not so
Bad,
great coming
bad.
in.
No, and I know that about myself. Like, I have to work out, or I'm like, well, and my blood pressure gets high quickly. Like, I'll get winded even doing like sort of normal tasks. So I have to be a lifelong exerciser. I know that about myself because I get in really bad shape when I don't. And so I sort of, one of my training partners who was brought in was this blue chip recruit who had set age group records in his county or in Canada. And his parents had both been co-MVPs of their college track team. And he came in and we started training together. And he would come into every season in really good shape. We would have done the same very light training over the summer.
So
He would
basically,
come.
he's like the guy who seems like the natural, right? So
Yeah,
he's the guy that won the
exactly.
genetic lottery. You're
Exactly.
the guy that's going to have to scrap and fight
Totally.
and barf into the trash cans.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. That's exactly what it was. And so we start training together, and he improves a little, very little, and I start improving like as if somebody injected me with rocket fuel, you know? And here we are doing the same things day after day. And I used to, you know, I would go away from the track sometimes to try to find like a place where my teammates wouldn't see me so I could throw up in the middle of workouts. Sometimes I wouldn't make it and they would see me. And I sort of became the recipient of this narrative from coaches, and even some of my teammates that, well, I had no talent, but man, was I tough because I was improving so rapidly. You know, almost every race, I would drop times at some point, and Scott, my training partner, would come in really fast at the beginning of the season and totally stagnate, and so they would say, "Well, he's kind of a head case, you know,"
He's
and
not reaching his potential. If only he worked as hard as Dave.
which I believed at the time, but we were doing the exact same thing,
Yeah,
stride for stride,
that never
every
crossed your
day.
mind. Like, wait a second, we are doing the same training. It isn't that simple.
No, I don't know. Like when you're in the moment, I mean, and then it did start to get to him though, because then I remember this day where, you know, he decided he was going to drop out of an 800-meter race at 600 meters, just treat it as practice, because he had stopped improving for such a long time that he was feeling a lot of pressure, you know, about not improving anymore, that he was somehow wasting his talent. You know, years later, of course, then I would start to see him hiding, puking too, and realize the same. He was in as much pain as I was, you know. So I like to think, oh yeah, I was so tough, and he was just talented. Not true. And of course, in the reporting of this book, I had some of my genes tested, and lo and behold, I have genes that indicate I'd be a high responder to the kind of training that we were doing. And I even got, at the end of my college track career, I got this amazing award for the 4-year athlete who overcomes, I think the wording was overcomes significant difficulty to achieve athletic success. My significant difficulty was just that I sucked at the outset.
Right, yeah, it sounds like what was difficult for you is that, like, if you're not training all the time, you're terrible. But
Yeah.
if you keep up with it, you were good. But nobody knew that. That's fascinating.
So they fit the story to what they could see, which was not our genetics.
Right. Now, speaking of that, even when we talk about the desire to practice, and this is like work ethic, basically, you're out on the track and you're pushing through that last set of sprints. Or you're under the squat rack, and it's like, one more round. It's like Rocky, one more round, stallion, right? Now we it's like, and speaking of Rocky, we always talk about that. It's a matter of motivation. It's willpower. How much do you really want it? Now, one of my absolute favorite things in the book, you write about research in mice, and one of these studies actually involved mice being doped up with Ritalin, which I'll have you explain real briefly. But it seemed like the study indicated that maybe a lot of what we think about as heart and desire and want to is actually rooted in brain chemistry, and that some of us are literally junkies for exercise, and some of us are like literally the opposite. Like, we're like, our brain chemistry makes us couch potatoes. How, without getting too much into the weeds, how does that work?
Well, and so of course I wouldn't minimize sort of motivation, because you can obviously manipulate your environment to increase motivation. But one of the most surprising findings to me while I was researching the book was that, you know, I knew full well that our biology responds to physical exercise. Sort of everybody knows that, and so does our dopamine system. The pleasure and reward system in the brain
Like
responds to
the runner's high, right?
that, right? And it responds to physical exercise. You know, all of your biology does. I was not aware that there was such voluminous literature that made it clear that physical activity also responds to your biology and to your dopamine system, and that your setup can make you feel more of a sense of pleasure and reward from being physically active, being in motion, and more sort of antsy from not training, basically, from not exercising. And these in what's been done now for years and years in mice is a researcher will take a group of random mice, just let them go ahead and run voluntarily on a wheel, because mice will run voluntarily on a wheel some amount, and then they just separate the ones that run more from the ones that run less, and breed the high runners with the high runners and the low runners with the low runners. And in just a few generations, they are utterly different animals. The high runners are running twice as much, and they start getting frantic if the wheel's taken away and they're not allowed to run. So they need to run. They are literally junkies. Like they display the characteristics that rodents that are bred for certain drug addictions display when they can't get the drug. And these gene variants are also present in humans, and so far the work suggests that they have some of the same functions. One of the really interesting papers I came across was this one that tested Arial tribesmen in Kenya, where some of them are nomadic and some of them are settled. And this dopamine receptor gene that we know predisposes people to ADHD is in much higher prevalence in the Arial tribesmen who are still nomadic, and it's disappearing in the ones that are settled. As if, and what the scientists suggest is that it leads them to want to be more physically active, the nomadic group, but it's disadvantageous in a settled group where hyperactivity is maybe not desirable, so it's disappearing there. And of course, oh sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, finish up.
As you say, what one of the scientists suggests, you know, one of the scientists who breeds these mice, what he sees in the high running mice is if he gives them Ritalin, which increases dopamine in the brain, then those high running mice run less. as if they've already gotten their dopamine fix from the drug. And he suggests that's the same thing we do with kids, right? Hyperactive children. We know that dopamine receptor gene variant predisposes kids to ADHD. So they're hyperactive, they move around. And if you give them this drug that drives their dopamine up, they stop moving around so much, which is great if you want them to sit still for 10 hours a day. Not so great if you want them to have a high drive to exercise.
Wow, that's, you know what, that could take this podcast in a whole different direction. But just to, no, it really could in terms of childhood obesity and medicating our children and all sorts of bigger picture issues. But we'll stick to, right now, we'll stick to the book a little bit. And it actually goes back to something you were just saying. You know, the way that environment can play a huge role in sort of the, I guess it's, you know, in sort of what's going on genetically. With you know, whether genes are being expressed or what's being passed down, you know, there's no way to talk about genetics in sports without, well, you can, but in general, people will bring in race and they'll bring in ethnicity, and it could be a real can of worms. So, one of the interesting things I found in the book was that, you know, it talks about, look, like skin color has nothing to do with anything going on here, but it could be the case. It seems to be the case that like body types and some other physical traits basically seem like they're adaptations to the physical environments that these that various ethnic groups were in for thousands of years. You know, from what we know from the science, you know, what are some of the most compelling evidence that sort of supports that or seems to build that out?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, skin color. So skin color does tell you something about someone's genetics and ancestry. It tells you that their ancestry is at low latitude, where they needed dark skin to, protect against equatorial sunlight. It doesn't tell you where. I mean, if we look at East Africans who dominate long distance running and West Africans who dominate sprinting, they couldn't be more physiologically different in terms of what they're good at. They all happen to hail from low latitude. But in one of the important physical differences that I highlight is that one thing that people with recent low latitude ancestry tend to have in common are long limb proportions compared to their overall body size. And that's something that's actually been well known for over a century. And it's called Allen's rule, actually, for the zoologist who discovered it, first documenting it just in other animals. So,
Right, that's something that's known across sort of the spectrum, not just humans, but pretty much animals across the board.
It started with other animals, and it's in having long limbs at low latitude and with recent ancestry in a hot, dry climate. It's an adaptation for cooling. It's the same reason why your radiator has lots of coils. It's to increase the surface area compared to the volume to let heat diffuse out. And so, for example, in animals, one of the ways you can tell an African elephant from an Asian elephant is because the African elephant has the long floppy ears, which is an adaptation that increases the surface area compared to the elephant's big volume for cooling. And it's the same for humans. So people with low latitude ancestry from hot and dry climates who happen to be black, because if you're of recent ancestry at low latitude, you need dark skin to protect against equatorial sunlight. Tend to have longer limbs proportional to their body size, sometimes by quite a bit. And that is a good thing for certain athletic skills like running, because all other things being equal, your running speed scales as the square root of your leg length. So everything else being equal, you want longer legs. And it's bad for things like swimming in general, where you want a really long torso and short legs. It's like the long hull of a canoe. So not like one body type is better than the other, but they certainly fit, into their different niches, the way like, Darwin's finches' beaks fit into their niches. So,
And the sports have become increasingly specialized in the last 100 years as they've become increasingly lucrative. We're seeing more specialization of body types, right? In some sense, that's sort of the story of sports, right?
Absolutely. So early in the 20th century, when scientists, largely this was kind of led by German science, and make your own inferences for German science in the 30s, but
Right, let's be careful right now.
yeah,
We don't
so
want to get any Godwin's Law territory here.
yeah, and so the claims were that the so-called average body type would be the best for every athletic endeavor, someone who was sort of very well-rounded. And the thinking was anything that deviates from the average is deviating kind of by accident or by fault. And so at the time, like in 1925, the average shot putter, elite shot putter and high jumper were the same height and weight.
That's
And
crazy.
today, they are 2.5 inches and 130 pounds apart on average. So now, of course, as the rewards became larger, and as this sort of winner-take-all effect that I described, where now instead of many people participating in sports and sort of local clubs, we all have a ticket to the Super Bowl, so we can all watch Peyton Manning instead of going, with the remote control instead of going and playing on by ourselves. So the rewards become much more concentrated with people like him, and so the global talent search becomes much more rigorous. So in that way, actually. Even as rigorous practice has gotten more important because athletes have gotten better and compete harder and more people are practicing, having specific biological endowments has become more important too, because there are now more people screened out of particular sports by not having a certain body type.
Right. If you're 7 feet tall and you can run, 100 feet without falling on your face, like somebody who coaches basketball is going to get their hands on you and try to make you a player.
Yeah, I mean as I in the chapter where I analyze NBA body types, and I used only real measurements of the guys with their shoes off,
Okay,
because
not the fake college measurements where
no,
he's 3
because I
inches taller.
realized a lot of 7-footers are actually 6'10" with their shoes off. So except for Shaq, he's true 7'1" with his shoes off. But if when I analyze that data along with data from the CDC on human height in Americans, it comes to an estimate that an American man between the ages of 20 and 40 who's at least 7 feet tall, if you know one, there's a 17% chance he's a current NBA player.
So basically, one in six guys who's that tall at that age just probably plays in the NBA. That's amazing.
The way I first got interested in that in this chapter actually was I was driving. I was driving somewhere for a story, and I was listening to Colin Cowherd on ESPN Radio, and he said he was talking about LeBron, and he was saying, "Well, yeah, of course LeBron's, talented, but there's a million guys who are 6'8" in America who aren't in the NBA." And
No,
I said, "Boy,
that can't be right.
I wonder how many guys there are in America who are 6'8". And it turns out it's about 20,000. It's like the population of Rolla, Missouri. It's not nearly a million. It's quite rare. So human height is a really narrowly constrained trait. About 70% of American men are just in the 6-inch range between 5'7" and 6'1". So that curve is like a Mount Everest. It really falls off on either end very quickly.
You say in the book that some of the scientists you talk to, publicly, they actually try to marginalize the importance of genetics in sports because they don't think it sends like a positive message. Now, do you think that's a good, do you agree with that or disagree with that? Do you think that's a good idea?
No.
To me, that was a very unusual thing to hear a scientist say, even if they're saying it to you sort of off the record or anonymously.
No, I think it's a terrible idea. I mean, maybe just because I'm a journalist, I'm inclined to think that like hiding from the truth is always going to come back to bite you. But a certain part of this, so writing about race and genetics almost scared me out of writing this book. And then a couple things kept me doing it, but one of them was I was at an American College of Sports Medicine conference in San Francisco, and the head of a kinesiology department at a major research university told me that he was hiding data because he had found ethnic differences. He was not going to not hide it. He said he wasn't going to publish it. That's what he said. And he had found it was a study on the response to a dietary supplement among exercisers, for goodness sake, and his concern was that, and he'd found differences between the black subjects and the white subjects, and his concern was that acknowledging these differences would somehow bolster speculation that there are also innate intellectual differences.
That
Okay,
seems like a
which,
pretty big jump.
yeah, okay, they have nothing to do with one. So the problem is there's been a bad history. So when
Right, you're
African
right.
Americans became overrepresented in sports in the 1930s, suddenly this idea cropped up that, well, in that case, if you're good at sports, for some reason, it's inversely proportional to how smart you are, or some
Right.
trash, But that idea was always a result of bigotry, never a cause of it. It didn't even exist until African Americans became associated with athletic prowess. But in this individual case, so I don't think that his research was like, wasn't going to be like earth-shattering if he didn't publish it. But there are other things like, so because people with recent African ancestry have longer limbs proportional to their body size, one of the diagnostic criteria for Marfan syndrome, which is a potentially fatal disease that causes the elongation of the limbs, doctors have to use different diagnostic criteria to diagnose and monitor African Americans and white Americans. So they have to concede certain ethnic differences if they're going to monitor that disease appropriately. Just last month, there was a paper published about tuberculosis showing that the immune systems of people of recent African ancestry react differently to tuberculosis than Europeans. Mm-hmm. And the tests that monitor tuberculosis rely on the immune response. So the conclusion of the paper was that these tests need to take ethnicity into account or you won't pick up properly every patient. And in one of the examples in the book, I talk about the United Nations saying that we should bring iron supplements to Africa because there's so many children who are dangerously anemic. Well, it turns out that some of those children have low iron levels and look dangerously anemic because of genetic conditions that protect them from malaria.
And if you bring up the iron levels, they actually become more susceptible, right, to malaria?
That's exactly what happened. So iron supplements were spread. Cases of severe illness and malaria death increased. And then after a double-blind placebo-controlled trial in Zanzibar that found more cases of malaria and severe malaria illness and death when iron supplements were given, the World Health Organization issued a statement like basically backtracking, saying, whoa, like maybe you shouldn't do this unless you can also protect them from malaria at the same time. So if you deny that genetic ancestry matters, you can get into really dangerous territory.
Right. And speaking of genetic ancestry, I thought there was a very interesting chapter in the book. It talks about Jamaica, and it talks about why such a small island is so dominant in sprint events.
Yeah.
And so there seemed to be these two different researchers. Yeah. One guy had this almost, like, I'm probably simplifying it, but he had almost like a Jimmy the Greek sort of like warrior-slave theory.
Yeah.
He felt like the strongest people had been bred. And then on top of that, there was a particularly strong group of them that were sort of like a warrior community, and they were cloistered in this tiny mountainous part of the country. And that's where all the great sprinters are now coming from. Another researcher basically said, no, that's pretty much bull. The real reason is that Jamaica, you know, as a society, it cares about track the way Texas cares about high school football. So while in a place like America, we have really fast athletes that will go into a variety of sports, everyone who's fast in Jamaica is going to become a sprinter, basically. Now, I have a third theory. This is a bit of an off-ramp, but this is based on talking to Victor Conti. And this is another areas of your expertise, which is Jamaica historically has very, very lax drug testing. And,
yeah,
and basically
true.
The island's a great place to dope and get away with it while you train.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? Are any of these things a real reason that Jamaica seems to disproportionately dominate in sprinting?
Well, I think what you're saying absolutely has to be factored in, unfortunately. You know, I think we're at the stage with Jamaica where we just have no idea, like, where doping is. And it's unfortunate that they haven't been more rigorous about testing, because having been to Jamaica, I can tell you it should be the easiest place to test in the world, because there are two tracks at which every runner you've heard of from Jamaica is at every morning.
So
one of two tracks.
You could find these people if you need to. If you're the person with the the urine collection jar.
It should be the easiest job in the world. I would just, when I wanted to go to practice, I just showed up at the University of Technology at 6 a.m. You know, and I waited around for an hour, and then every member of the Jamaican 4x1 except Usain Bolt was there every time
right.
I showed up.
And I think,
and
Bolt
was at another
track.
You
know, maybe maybe they are starting to target test more, because we've seen a number of Jamaican runners recently kind of fail tests or get busted. Now, I wanted to ask, and this isn't in the book, but speaking of doping, and this is kind of a hot topic right now, you wrote a recent article for the new MMQB website, and it was about HGH testing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I never saw this anywhere else, but you wrote the actual test the NFL is considering implementing, which has been the subject of lots of controversy, and
you know,
people in Congress have gotten involved, and you actually wrote that particular test is of very limited value.
Yeah.
And they might be better off considering a different type of test. So, you know, why did you write that?
Well, so much of this argument has been this NFL stalemate has been about the so-called HGH isoform tests that looks for HGH comes in two main forms in the body, but the synthetic kind you inject only comes in one of those, so it upsets the ratio of those, and that's what the test looks for. And the fact is that ratio renormalizes in hours after you take it, so the test detection window is terrible. Like, the first, there were thousands of tests on Olympic athletes using the HGH isoform test before they had one positive, and that was because somebody got tipped off that a guy was using HGH right now.
So this is
Terry Newton. So they went and tested him.
So this is basically, this, to me, this sounds a lot like a lot of the tests for, you know, testosterone ratio, where basically if I'm using some sort of, you know, low level fast acting cream, it's pretty unlikely I'm going to get caught unless you test me right after I rubbed it into my skin.
Yeah, and a lot of tests are like that, but I think the isoform test now is on even worse ground because recently one of the few positive tests was overturned for an Estonian skier who his levels were off the charts. But the way that he won his appeal was in challenging the basically the goal line that WADA sets that differentiates a positive from a negative, because they're in this sort of strange area of science where they can't say, like, you know, if you get your blood pressure tested, somebody says it's high or it's really high or it's low,
right.
Whereas WADA has to say positive or negative or abnormal,
right.
Or normal.
They have to draw some sort of arbitrary,
right.
You know,
yeah.
Even though these things vary in people who aren't doping, they
right.
have to draw some sort of arbitrary line.
And yeah. And so they end up drawing that line extremely conservatively because of that. So first of all, so in one of the early tests of the, in one of the early studies of the isoform test that was just done for sort of scientific research, none of the subjects who were intentionally doped for the study reached the level that would be a current positive.
Okay, this sounds like a very good test, though.
No,
it's like a pretty bad test.
Right. I think that, you know, they're trying to put, I mean, some people get a little upset with me when I write about it like this, because I don't think that some in anti-doping sort of want that to be known. You know, they want it to be out there as a deterrent. And the NFL certainly wants it to be out there, you know, to say, okay, well, get Congress off their back or whatever.
Oh, sure. Well, let me ask you, you know, this is something, again, that Victor Conti argues all the time, and I actually happen to agree with him, that something like this, or the number of different loopholes, and even, like I said, some loopholes aren't that closable because it's difficult, tricky science, and sometimes these loopholes are closable, but they're not doing it.
Yeah.
He argues that this indicates that a lot of anti-doping policies are basically for PR purposes, that it's, you know, it's in the best interest, essentially, of leagues and sports to look like they are serious about preventing doping, to catch a few particularly stupid and careless athletes, but don't catch too many of them. Now, I totally fall into that camp, but you know more about this than probably anybody else in sports writing. Victor Conti and I, are we being too cynical? Or
well,
do you think there's some merit to that idea?
Well, let me sort of I'll just share one anecdote, and I think that'll help, which is when the NFL and Major League Baseball decided to fund some of the research for a urine-based growth hormone test, which ended up not working,
mm-hmm.
They bought some really large advertisements that I have to imagine cost quite a bit more than the money they actually gave to the research, saying that they were giving the money to the research. So that said,
right? That shows your priority.
Yeah. So do I think that they are making efforts? Do I think that they don't want doping? Oh, I absolutely think they don't want doping. But I just don't know of a system where self-policing, especially in this case, like, what is their incentive to catch anybody?
Right.
I think, you know, Bud Selig was very very hurt by the idea that he was looking the other way, and I think he's been pretty successful at changing the narrative to now being someone who's mm-hmm. hard on drugs. But from a league-wide perspective, where is their incentive?
Right.
You know, so I wouldn't expect anything different from them.
No, I agree with you. I mean, if I'm the NFL, for instance, why would I want a rash of positive tests?
Yeah, do you want to be track and field?
Right, exactly.
No.
Exactly. It hasn't been really helpful to track and field. Let me ask you a last question here. Where, as usual, I'm way over the time I'm supposed to be talking, but that's okay because this is a great discussion. Go back to the book, and let's go back to that original idea of nature and nurture. Now, like, you mentioned this earlier, but there's this tremendous chapter. It talks about two high jumpers. They're both elite guys, world class. One's from Sweden, this guy, Stefan Holm. He is like almost the ultimate nurture guy in some ways.
Yeah.
He's obsessively practicing the high jump since childhood.
Yeah.
You know, before his meets, he has this precise pattern of what he eats for breakfast,
yeah.
cornflakes and orange juice. He wears a certain color of socks. He puts his shoes on the same way. And it's not because he's all OCD. It's because he wants to avoid the mental strain of making small
yeah.
decisions. Much like, by the way, President Obama has his, you know, he talked about how he has his suits put out every morning, because he makes so many decisions every day, so I have to burn any mental energy, which is actually a real scientific phenomenon, which is kind of funny. Now, Holm, he gets a gold medal in the 2004 Olympics,
yeah.
best in the world. Then there's this other guy, this Bahamian guy, Donald Thomas, who basically seems to get into high jumping by like a joke. Like there's some guys on his college track team that are like, you know what, we're tired of hearing you brag about your slam dunk ability. Like, why don't you come out here and see what you can do on the high jump? They put out a bar. He clears 7 feet with no technique and no training, and he's wearing tennis shoes, like almost as a joke. And he ends up winning the 2007 World Championship, even though he says himself, high jumping is kind of boring. Now, it turns out his secret is that he has this abnormally long Achilles tendon that basically acts like an incredible jumping spring. So my question is this: if one guy devotes his entire life to peak performance, I mean, every aspect almost of his life, and this other dude basically strolls onto the track and can almost match him, and with a little bit of training can beat him, what are we are supposed to conclude about what it takes to be an elite athlete?
I think the when I applied it to the 10,000 hours, the one was that you can get to the same place by two tremendously different paths, and I think that can be sort of disconcerting for a Stephen Holm in a way, you know, because he entered that competition in 2007 as the favorite, where Donald Thomas beat him, and Stephen Holm's father was so disconcerted that he basically, you know, threw a fit afterward and said that Donald Thomas's form, where he kicks his feet and he like sits up in the air and he puts his hands back because he's afraid of falling backward, was such a scandal for high jump that it would like scare children away from trying high jump, you know. He's a pretty extreme guy.
So his mind was just blown. It's like, you know, we worked so hard on this, and then here comes this guy out of nowhere.
I mean, and I can imagine that, because if I heard of a high school kid winning a state championship that way, I would be flabbergasted. Much less a world champion walking out. When I went to interview Stephen Holm, who's sort of very staid and he doesn't do a lot of media, and I kept asking him, like, he kept saying, like, oh, Donald, it's so great for high jump and all this, like, what a phenomenon. And I kept being like, Stephen, come on. You know, and eventually he was like, it's a he goes, it's an effing Hollywood movie and I'm the bad guy. I was like, oh, all right, now I see it. But yeah, I mean, I prefer to think of it like, you know, some scientists told me one of the reasons they didn't want to talk about innate talent was because it detracts from the hard work that athletes have put in. I disagree. I don't think anybody acknowledging that Michael Jordan is taller than whatever 99, probably point something percent of the population, and he has that genetic gift. I never met anyone who would denigrate his hard work and skill because of that. Okay, we all try to find, you know, where we can get positive reinforcement and improvement. And I just think sports is this beautiful display of human biological diversity where you can see that in action in a way with a Stephen Holm, with a Donald Thomas, that I have never seen in anything else. And that's kind of what I now love the most about sports.
And you know, with Holm, like you talked about earlier, we don't know. Maybe Holm has some sort of, you know, biological genetic traits that we don't really understand that helped him or led him to be so obsessive about practicing, to be able to dedicate himself that way.
Oh yeah, I mean, because he obsess with high jump out of the way, he obsesses about other stuff. He's like, if you go look at his website, you'll see some Lego stuff on there. He's like totally obsessed with Legos now.
So he replaced one obsession with another. And it's funny, a lot of times you see athletes who are very obsessive with training and working and perfecting their craft. They do end up finding something else later in life that's similar. And I always did wonder, was that just sort of it we call a personality trait, but are those personality traits actually connected to biology? And probably there's you talking about in the book, that probably it's probably a mix.
One of the when I was thinking about maybe doing some behavioral genetics chapter, but there was so much sort of the science was sort of so hard to parse. There was so many like contradictory studies, but that I decided not to do it. But I remember this one twin study I came across where these two identical twins who were separated at birth and only met as adults were interviewed by scientists, and both guys were like fastidiously clean, like really neat and clean. And one of them said, "Well, of course I was, because my adoptive mother was really clean and I took after her." And the other one said, "Well, of course I was. My adoptive mother was such a slob, I never wanted to be like her." And so maybe both of those environmental inputs are true. Maybe, or maybe
Maybe they were
they
just
just
born
fit
to
the
be
story to
clean.
what they could see. Yeah.
Right.
So.
Well, look, we're at, like I said, we're way over time, so we're out of time here. I really enjoy this. I would love to have you back on again sometime. Definitely keep an eye on all your work at Sports Illustrated. I'm sure something will come up that'll be good. Didn't even get to talk to you about the whole deer antler story, which I think that all of America missed the actual point of that story, but maybe we'll get to that conversation another time. In the meantime, tell people again the title of your book and also how to follow you on Twitter.
My book is The Sports Gene: Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. It's just out, fresh off, hot off the presses, and I'm at SI David Epstein on Twitter.
Terrific. Well, for now, I am Patrick Rubio of Sports on Earth. This has been the Ruby Tuesday podcast, and goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.